From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Actors on Acting, Peter O'Toole tells us about his childhood with his father, the bookie, and about the ordeals of riding a camel while filming the battle scenes in Lawrence of Arabia. The voice of authority, James Earl Jones, recalls the time when his voice didn't command so much attention. And Squeal Like a Pig. We hear from character actor Ned Beatty. He's best known for his debut in Deliverance. Now he's a detective on Barry Levinson's TV series, Homicide. That's all coming up on this edition of Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A series of strong aftershocks has rocked Southern California today. Authorities are trying to clean up damage and convince frightened residents to move out of parks where they've been camping and into real shelters. Health authorities worry if people stay living in parks and ball fields with unsanitary conditions, there could be wide outbreaks of disease. National weather forecasters are predicting an end to the deep freeze now icing the Midwest and the East. But the problems that it's caused are not yet over. Pennsylvania set low record temperatures today. Williamsport was 18 degrees below zero. The cold is also blamed for an overnight water main break in New York City that flooded a main traffic tunnel between Brooklyn and Manhattan. The rush of water has forced at least 100 people to leave their homes. In Atlanta, weather-related water woes are getting better. Workers have almost finished fixing three major water mains that have snapped in the cold. The Food and Drug Administration has announced new regulations to improve the safety of seafood. Commissioner David Kessler says the rules will require seafood processors to monitor fish from boat to table.
Today we are proposing a system of preventive controls. We are acting to head off potential problems. The system we are proposing draws its strength from one simple principle. The best way to provide safe food is to build safety into food products during the production process.
But consumer groups say the new rules don't go far enough. Mark Epstein of Public Voice calls them a good first step, but the FDA, he says, still needs to increase authority and funding if it's truly going to tackle the problem. Secretary of State Warren Christopher is in Norway for the funeral of Foreign Minister Holst. He's going to meet with Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres and PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat while he's there. Arab-Israeli negotiations resume on Monday in Washington. Barry Schwide reports.
Norway is where Israel and the PLO secretly agree to begin turning power over to Palestinians on the West Bank and in Gaza. The agreement hasn't been implemented, though. Christopher will try to steer Peres and Arafat into overcoming their differences. The U.S. has a large stake. Having had almost nothing to do with the secret negotiations, the Clinton administration wants to see the agreement through because it strongly supports Palestinian self-rule. On Monday, Israel will resume formal negotiations with Syria and other Arab delegations, this time under arrangements designed to keep the press and the public away. The sites of the talks won't be announced in advance. The negotiators won't be asked to respond to questions from reporters about the positions they are taking or whether they are making progress. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up nearly 19 points at 3,910. This is NPR. The son of Syrian President Hafez al-Assad has been killed in a car crash. Bashar al-Assad was his father's reported chosen successor to eventually take power in Syria. NPR's Paul Miller reports from Jerusalem.
Syrian state radio reported Bashar al-Assad's death in what it called a tragic accident. Damascus radio stations are playing only classical and religious music between newscasts. First reports of the death came from Beirut, where radio stations said the younger Assad had died in a car crash near Damascus. Bashar al-Assad was in charge of relations with Lebanon. Syria watchers say it was a position of responsibility, given Syria's involvement in Lebanon. They believe Bashar al-Assad was being trained to succeed his father, who has ruled for 24 years but has been in poor health for some time. The loss of a successor could mean political instability in a country which has had its share of political intrigue despite Assad's dictatorship. His brother Rifat was banished from the country for several years for posing a threat to the regime. I'm Paul Miller in Jerusalem.
North Korea is blaming the International Atomic Energy Agency for the dispute over its nuclear facilities, but the agency says the North Koreans are balking at inspection procedures that it proposed. The exchange of allegations is weakening hopes inspections could soon resume. It could also increase tension. Earlier this month, the Clinton administration said North Korea had agreed to let the UN agency determine what inspections are needed to verify that Pyongyang's nuclear program is peaceful. North Korea insists that it is. Indonesia won't let basketball star Magic Johnson into the country because he has HIV, the virus associated with AIDS. Johnson had wanted to accompany his touring all-star basketball team into the country, but Indonesia has a law empowering the government to prevent people with contagious diseases from entering the country. Johnson had been invited to Indonesia by the country's basketball association. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we're playing some of our favorite interviews with actors. Peter O'Toole has played everything from God in John Huston's epic The Bible to a washed-up drunken movie star in the comedy My Favorite Year. He starred in the historical dramas Beckett and The Lion in Winter. But the role he's probably most associated with is Lawrence of Arabia. O'Toole's latest work isn't a movie, it's a book. The first volume of his memoirs called Loitering with Intent. Terry Gross spoke with him last April, right after the book was published. Most of the book is about his childhood, growing up in northern England during the war. O'Toole's father was a racetrack bookie. Terry asked him what it was like to have a gambling father.
I loved it in the pre-war years when he was on top, when he was flush. I loved it. I loved going to all the tracks, meeting all the people. Learning how to count by understanding the odds, memorizing the names of the horses and the jockeys, looking at the colors, the silks, looking at the animals, looking at the countryside. I loved it, and I loved, of course, being with my father and my mother. Times got a bit more grim when the war came and racing ended, but they cheered up again at the end of the war. Yes, in short, yes, it was lovely.
Did your father ever expect you to go into the gambling business?
No, he didn't. He might have expected me to, but he didn't encourage me to, and neither did I. Though I did gamble quite a lot until I was about 30 or so, then it petered out. I mean, for instance, Omar Sharif and I. Do you know Omar Sharif?
Well, not personally, but I certainly know his roles.
Well, he's a lovely man.
In Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah, well, he's not only was he in Lawrence of Arabia, but we've remained friends ever since, and he's a graceful and intelligent man, a lovely man. We were in Beirut in the better days, and we were playing, cards, and we lost all the money we'd earned in 9 months, we lost in one night in Beirut. And then a year later, we were in Casablanca, and all the money we'd earned in that year, we lost, but in two nights.
Well, did you have enough money that you could afford to gamble away a whole year's earning in one night?
Certainly not. But we did gamble it away in one night, and then in two nights.
Were you drunk that night, and how did it feel to wake up the next morning knowing all that you'd lost?
Well, we weren't sober, but neither were we unconscious. We were fully aware of the pain and agony of watching all our pennies go down the Swanee.
Peter O'Toole is my guest. He's written a new memoir called Loitering with Intent. It's about his early years. Well, when you were a young man, you went into the Navy. Then when you got out of the Navy, you got yourself an audition at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts. You kind of talked your way into the audition. How did you do it?
Series of accidents, circumstances, blunders. A chum of mine who intended to be a painter and I hitchhiked our way into London to begin our lives, and we jumped off the truck, at a station called Euston, and we were aiming for a men's hostel. The street which goes from the station to the hostel is called Gower Street. And we were plodding down it, and I looked, and on my left it said the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. And my chum said, well, if you're going to be an actor, you know, it's a kind of shop where they deal with such matters, so why don't you pop in? So I popped in. And I saw a bust of Bernard Shaw. And I was looking at the bust of Bernard Shaw, and the commissioner, the sergeant commissioner, joined me at the bus, and we started yarning about Bernard Shaw, telling stories, and he told me his stories, and I told him my stories. And then we were joined by a gentleman, an elderly gentleman, a burly, gruff gentleman, and he turned out to be the principal of the Royal Academy, and he asked me if I was a student. And I said, no, I wasn't, but I was thinking of being, and one thing led to another, and I found myself, that afternoon even, turning up for the first interview. And then I did an audition, and then I did another audition, and I found, to my surprise, that I was in.
What did you do for your auditions?
The first one was a bit of Chesterton and a bit of Bernard Shaw.
What did you choose from Shaw?
Shaw?
Yeah.
Pygmalion.
Mm-hmm.
Higgins.
Do you remember the lines?
I've got to live here for the next 6 months, learning how to speak beautifully like a lady in a florist's shop. Yeah, that bit.
Now, you weren't from the kind of background where you grew up speaking, you know, proper English or the Queen's English, were you?
Well, it was the King's English in my day.
The King's English, that's right. Excuse me.
He popped his clogs later on. But yes, my mother always spoke rather beautiful. She was a Scotswoman. And as you probably know, that the best English is spoken, I'm told, in Edinburgh. And she always spoke rather properly and corrected me whenever time I was improper.
Did you see a particular niche for yourself on stage when you were at the Royal Academy?
No, I didn't. I just rather enjoyed being a student in London and messing around, doing what students do and thoroughly enjoying the life. Then I was given a job at the end of 2 years. I was given a job at the Theatre Royal in Bristol, at the Bristol Old Vic Theatre Company, a repertory company. And at the end of the first year, having done about 12 or so plays, playing comparatively minor roles, I began to believe that I could do it, that I could act.
Were you given any advice about what type of character you would likely play?
Yes, I was. I remember one man saying, you'll spend your life or your early years popping through a French window with a tennis racket, saying anyone for tennis. But that didn't prove to be the case. I've never popped through French windows with or without a tennis racket and invited anyone to play tennis, or not.
And that's a lucky break, too, isn't it? Well,
you see, the young men, if you're given a certain cast of physiognomy, you find yourself playing the juvenile, and juveniles can be crucifyingly boring. The producer will often say, don't forget, he gets the girl. But, you know, one doesn't want to get the girl, wants to be covered in wigs and humps and being villains or being anything other than the juvenile. The whole world of the juvenile changed in 1956, 57, when John Osborne wrote Look Back in Anger. And there was a juvenile, he was 24, 25, who had all the good stuff, all the practical pudding that usually the character actors had. So the world changed then, and that was lovely. I enjoyed playing Jimmy Porter.
Well, not only didn't you make your career saying anyone for tennis, but your first real big movie role was in the epic Lawrence of Arabia. Were you kind of surprised to get the role?
Astonished. I can't imagine anyone whom I'm less like than T.E. Lawrence. But that's what David wanted, I think, someone who could act it rather than be it.
David Lean, the director.
That's right, David Lean, the director. My master, a man I really did admire enormously.
So the movie was shot on location, obviously. Which parts of the desert was it shot in?
You tell me. we were in Jordan, and between Jordan and the Saudi Arabian border. I think sometimes we nipped over the border, but we didn't know, for it was uncharted desert. And what we would do, we were based in Aqaba, and there was a big DC-3, which would take off with the cameras and us in it, and then we'd find a mud flat and land and pitch tents and generators and all that, and film.
So where would you live during the shooting, which I imagine took a very long time?
It took 9 months in the desert of Jordan. Where we lived in tents. Occasionally I had a caravan. We'd shoot for about 10 to 12 days and then have 2 or 3 days off. And I'd either go to Jerusalem, which I love, or to Beirut, Omar and I, where we'd squander our pieces at poker.
Oh, so that was the time when you lost all the money while you were making the movie?
In Beirut. Then we went off to Spain after 9 months in the desert. And I love the desert. I really did. I got involved with a Bedouin, and I liked charging around with that. I was there 3 months before filming started, and the idea was to learn to ride a camel.
Was it hard to learn to ride the camel?
Impossible. What you see is a European perched uneasily on the top of this huge brute, snorting and galloping.
Well, it looks so uncomfortable the way you're positioned on there with one leg over the side of the camel and the other leg crossed over the hump.
Side saddle, precisely. And that there are two things that stick up like nails on the pommels of this wooden saddle. And it's if you ride a horse, you're finished because you can't post or anything like that. You just bounce. I found after a while that my bottom was bleeding from bouncing up and down on this snorting great dragon. And I went to Beirut, not to gamble this time, but to buy sponge rubber. And it was, I remember, mucous membrane pink. And I arrived back to my Bedouin friends with this lump of thick, thick rubber. And I stuffed it shamelessly onto my saddle. And, of course, they were saying, But after a while, they looked and they saw that it was quite comfy too, and you could bounce more easily on sponge rubber than you could on wood and hump. So they began to ask me to buy more. So I was requisitioning tons of this damn stuff, yards of it, and I think I introduced sponge rubber into Arabian culture. The Bedouin called me Abu... They couldn't say sponge, so they called me Abu Svinge, the father of rubber.
Actor Peter O'Toole is my guest. Back after a break, this is Fresh Air. My guest is actor Peter O'Toole. He's just written the first volume of his memoirs. There are a lot of scenes in Lawrence of Arabia where the camera seems to be almost several miles away from the people being shot.
Yeah, you're quite right. And that soul on the camel, all those many, many miles away, is invariably me.
Yes. Well, what was it like to know that you were being shot at such a great distance? And, of course, then, you know, the camera could, like, zoom in for a closer... I mean, they could zoom in with the lens, you know, for a closer shot, but that must have been pretty disorienting.
Initially, one was peeved. I remember David Lean saying to me, I had a stuntman doing it, all those shots that were miles and miles away. And David said, look at through the lens, Peter, look at the stuntman. So I did, and he said, you see, no poetry. So I found myself being the poet, and I was the one bouncing up and down miles and miles away. But it was all right. I had a transistor radio plugged into my ears, and I had a cigarette going, and I had a little bottle of something in the saddlebag. I was quite comfy. And the man who taught me to ride and who did all those shots, of those amazing shots of the desert, was a man called Kutayfun Abu Tai, who was the grandson of the man whom Anthony Quinn played. Abu Tai.
Oh.
Aouda Abu Tai. There was a strange thing. When the film was collected together again and the bits that had been missing were restored and glued back into place, we were in New York for the opening, David Lean and Omar Sharif and Alec Guinness and Anthony Quinn, the ones of us who were still alive. And having been introduced to the audience again, they were expecting to see this dark-haired beauty, Omar Sharif, and this blonde-haired little god, me, and I came toddling. We were like the Chelsea pensioners, these ancient old warriors came waddling into the spotlight. Then the lights went down and the music began, and there was a place which had been apportioned for us VIPs to sit, but I didn't. I just sat down on the front, all alone on the front row, just as I used to do as a child. And boom, on came the film. And when we came to those shots of the desert, I wasn't looking at the picture. I was just remembering what went on. Oh, that was the day that so-and-so broke his neck. Yes, that was the day when so-and-so. And we came to this huge shot of the desert. And it's a scene when one Bedouin says, tomorrow, good riding. And it cuts to this huge panorama of the desert, the painted desert, the many colours, and the two of us galloping on camels. Well, that was Kutaifan Abu Tai, who was killed in the late 60s. And I was very moved.
What was it like to be in the middle of some of those chaotic battle scenes? Is it pretty frightening knowing that even though it's just a movie, things can still go wrong?
Well, there was the charge at Aqaba, which I shall never forget, because we were then in Spain. We'd left Aqaba, and we'd built Aqaba in Spain. I know, this is the logic of filmmaking. And it was downhill, on shale, about a mile and a half to the cardboard Aqaba we'd built, cardboard minarets. And we'd imported from Morocco plow camels. Now, your camel may look just like a great humped brute to you, but there are fine distinctions. In Arabia proper, we'd had camels called dhaluls, which are bred for racing purposes, and they're bought in Damascus, and they cost a great deal of money. And here we were with Moroccan plough camels who had never, ever had a thing on their backs and had never, ever gone quickly in their poor little lives. And I thought, this is going to be a bit tasty. So I looked at Omar, a gambling man, and said, what are you going to do? He said, I've been working out the odds. I said, have you really? He said, yes, I've been working out the odds about whether or not I fall off the camel or whether the camel falls over. And I've decided that the odds are very strongly on me falling off the camel. So I said, yes. He said, so I've decided that I'm going to tie myself on. I thought, really? Tie yourself onto a camel? Because we were surrounded by 400 horses. We had to lead, Omar and I had to lead, on a handful of, a dozen or so, 20, 50 camels, with 400 horses galloping behind us. And we had to lead this charge. And Omar said, I'm going to tie myself on. I thought, well, I don't want to tie myself on. Not really. Tie yourself on a camel? No. I said, no, I'm going to get drunk. He said, oh, I'm going to get drunk too. So we both got a bottle of brandy and we shoved it into milk and we swallowed back the milky brandy, which made us feel not a lot of pain, hopped on our beasts and did it. And I was described in one newspaper having a look of messianic ecstasy on my face. what it was terror compounded with slightly being, a little bit pissed. It was rather nice, really, on the whole. And we made it. We got to the other end all right, right to the sea. And I stood on my camel. We stood in the water, and I looked, and to my right was Omar. And he was still tied to the camel, but he was hanging on upside down.
Was it easier to stay on the camel being slightly inebriated? I'd think it would be harder.
It was less... It was less. Look, the prospect was being trampled to death by 400 horses.
Yeah.
So it seemed to be, if one was going to be trampled to death by 400 horses, at least have a smile on your face, I thought.
Be a little more relaxed about it.
A bit more relaxed.
Peter O'Toole is my guest, and he's written a new memoir called Loitering with Intent. One of the films of yours I especially like is My Favorite Year.
That's good fun.
Yeah, and you play a washed-up actor from the swashbuckling era, a la Errol Flynn, who's making a guest shot on a Sid Caesar-type variety show. And you walk in you're soused all the time. Were you able to play off your image of having been a real drinker?
The first thing to say that he was not an actor, as he points out very clearly as he's going into the television. I'm not an actor, he says, I'm a movie star.
That's right. The
second thing is that, yes, it did provide an opportunity for hilarious self-caricature, which I enjoyed thoroughly.
You were telling us about how you drank during the battle scene in Aquaba. How often did you drink when you were performing?
Never.
Uh-huh.
Never. You can't do it. You can't act and drink or whatever. You can't do it. It's impossible. You need all your faculties clear and pure and spinning. Can't have it fuddled and muddied.
So it was only like for stunt-type sequences that you would do that?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
You stopped drinking a while ago?
I did.
Was that hard?
Not at all.
It's usually hard for people, that's why I ask.
No, I didn't. I stopped because I didn't like it anymore. I didn't like the effect anymore. If I fancied a drink right now, I'd have one, but I don't fancy one.
Mm-hmm. How much acting are you doing now?
None at all.
And why is that?
I'm not acting. I'm not in a play. I'm just me droning on with a pair of earphones on at this furry mic in front of me.
Oh, I didn't mean right this very second. How much are you acting? I mean at this point in your career.
How much acting am I? Oh, yeah, I see what you mean. Not a lot. I'm doing more scratching, scribbling, writing.
Uh-huh. And what led you in that direction to start writing?
An urge.
An urge to write or an urge to tell your story?
No, an urge to write. I tried a novel. That was a failure. I'd written a few things and a publisher saw it and suggested to me that I write my story. So I said, I don't think I can do that. Then I began to try, and I'm doing it.
What did you go back to spark your memory about the early days that you're writing about, your childhood?
Well, I have a host of memories which I see very clearly, and though I'm fully aware of the tricks of memory, I'm also aware of the concrete nature of these brilliantly lit pictures in my mind. And they'll never go. They're ineradicable. I'll give you an example. I'd written a bit about my childhood, and I got a hint of how to do all this from a line spoken by a Spaniard many years ago. I don't know who he was or when he was, but he said, I am I and my circumstances. Yo y mis circunstancias. And that clicked with me. If I could describe the circumstances of my life as well as me being in them, that was the clue to how I set about writing. But I'd written a passage, and I thought, hang on, you've described very clearly an abbey and stepping stones and this, that, and the other. I put the pen down, having finished that particular passage, and I jumped in my car, and I drove the 200 or 300 miles to the spot, which I hadn't seen for 40 years, and as I got there, off the motorway, along the little boreens that led to it, I found myself just chuckling, all alone in the car. Chuckle, 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 because it was exactly as I remembered it. Oh, certain things were different, but the colours, the shapes, everything, the water, the abbey, the stones, they were all there.
Peter O'Toole. He spoke with Terry Gross last April. His first volume of memoirs is called Loitering with Intent. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. When he talks, people listen. Coming up, actor James Earl Jones. His authoritative voice commands attention, but there was a time when he didn't want to be heard. Jones tells us about his stutter and why he virtually stopped speaking in public when he was growing up. Also, since his memorable debut in Deliverance, character actor Ned Beatty has appeared in numerous movies and TV shows. These days, he's Detective Stanley Bolander on the critically acclaimed TV series Homicide. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Southern California earthquake victims are standing in line at emergency relief centers. Most people are just getting applications and an appointment to discuss disaster aid. But many frustrated people are angry because they don't have houses or belongings or help. The Federal Emergency Management Agency is also warning that people need shelter immediately. Weather forecasters are predicting rain and colder temperatures over the weekend. Richard Krim is FEMA's Director of Recovery Services.
In many cases, the canyons were choked with debris, and there's a possibility that the rain forecast for this weekend may cause debris flows. And this could pose a major hazard to developments farther down the canyons. We're also concerned about the rains in that they could cause mudslides in the areas that were affected by the fires earlier in California.
The California National Guard is putting up tents that will house thousands of homeless people. California transportation officials say they've made some patchwork repairs to earthquake-damaged Interstate 5. They might be able to open the vital roadway as early as next week, but the authorities say the temporary repairs will only accommodate about half the normal volume of cars it generally serves. Utility officials say conservation by power customers on the East Coast is working. The officials say because people have reduced power usage, service probably won't be interrupted today. Service in several states had to be temporarily shut off this week for brief periods of time in several states because of unusually cold weather. In New York, a water main break has forced about 200 people from their homes and shut down the nation's second longest automobile tunnel. Don Matheson, a member station WNYC, reports.
Before dawn, people were forced from their homes in the Cobble Hill section of Brooklyn when a water main burst. Muddy water gushed down streets, filled basements, and flowed into the nearby Brooklyn Battery Tunnel. An emergency Red Cross shelter has been set up in a local public school. Record-breaking cold temperatures caused the water to freeze. Electric and gas service has been cut off to a three-block area of row houses. The gushing water has caused one local street to collapse. Tens of thousands of motorists are being inconvenienced. Much of the escaping water collected in a toll plaza and on the roadway of the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel, which connects Manhattan's financial district to major arteries in Brooklyn. For National Public Radio, I'm Don Matheson in New York.
A jury in Manassas, Virginia has acquitted Lorena Bobbitt of sexually mutilating her husband, John Wayne Bobbitt. The jury accepted the defense's contention she suffered a psychotic episode after years of verbal and physical abuse by her husband. On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed today. The Dow reached another record high, gaining more than 22 points to close at 3,914. This is NPR. The Associated Press is quoting an unidentified source who says three of the four men charged with attacking figure skater Nancy Kerrigan are talking with prosecutors about possible plea bargains. A grand jury is meeting in Portland, Oregon, to determine if skater Tanya Harding should also be indicted in the alleged plot. A prosecutor says no indictments will be issued this week. Harding's bodyguard, Sean Eckhart, who's been charged in the case, has implicated Harding in the alleged plot. She has denied any involvement. Gunmen blasted automatic weapons fire into a minibus outside of Johannesburg early today, killing five people and wounding nine. Police have raided a migrant workers' hostel near the attack site and arrested 13 people and confiscated several AK-47s. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
The attack came in Vosloorus, one of several black townships east of Johannesburg that have seen months of bloody clashes. Much of the township violence is sparked by tensions between hostel dwellers, many of whom support the Inkatha Freedom Party, and other township residents who support the African National Congress. Witnesses to this morning's attack told police they saw three gunmen take refuge in a nearby hostel whose residents are mainly Zulu migrant workers. Within hours, some 400 policemen raided the hostel, confiscating weapons, ammunition, marijuana, and police uniforms. Most of those arrested were charged with illegal possession of weapons. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
Fuel deliveries have started going to humanitarian agencies in Haiti. 400,000 gallons of oil were permitted to enter Haiti. It's the first shipment since the UN reimposed an oil embargo against the nation last October. The relief agencies have desperately needed the oil to cook food for thousands of starving people. The ruling military government hasn't interfered with the first fuel deliveries. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane sitting in for Terry Gross on today's archive program featuring actors on acting. James Earl Jones has a voice that conveys power and authority. He was the voice of Darth Vader in Star Wars. Now he's the voice of CNN. But ironically, his voice was the source of many troubles and frustrations when he was growing up. In his new memoir, Voices and Silences, James Earl Jones writes about his personal life and his career on stage in such plays as The Blacks, The Blood Knot, The Great White Hope, Othello, and Fences. In films such as Field of Dreams, Coming to America, and Summersby, and on TV in The Vernon John Story and Gabriel's Fire. He spoke with Terry Gross last September after his memoirs were published. Jones grew up in rural Mississippi. His family moved to Michigan when he was just a boy. In retrospect, he credits this uprooting with causing his stutter. As a child, the stutter was very bad. In fact, there was a period between the ages of 6 and 14 when he barely spoke at all.
I did the basics. I was able to function as a farm kid, doing all those chores where you call animals. I think I had my best conversations with the dog, who was a good friend of mine and didn't challenge me in any way. I certainly let the family know what my needs were. But when strangers came to the house, the mute happened. I didn't want to confront them, and I wasn't ready. I hid in the state of muteness.
Did you not want to speak, or did you feel physically unable to speak?
It was just too embarrassing.
Because of the stutter?
And too difficult, yeah.
Well, what were some of the things that adults or friends did to try to coax you to talk more?
No, they left me alone. My family had a habit of letting me have my way a lot when it came to sometimes major life decisions. But when it was about me, they let me decide. And that was one of them, when I wanted to leave the church, leave Sunday school, leave the religion because of the stuttering and because of the kids laughing. They accepted that. You know.
Even though your grandmother was very religious.
Oh, boy, was she ever. She's... Yeah, she was a triple born again. You know.
Can you tell us the story of how you started speaking again?
Donald Crouch was an associate of...
Donald Crouch was your teacher?
Yeah, Robert Frost. He was a college professor, but he ended up in this high school because he retired. He was a Mennonite farmer, and he retired to his farm in Brethren, Michigan. And the idea that there were kids down the road at this high school who were studying Chaucer and Shakespeare and stuff... He couldn't stand it, so he came back and taught high school, you know. He was the first English teacher I had. Now, see, I'm stuttering again. He was the first English teacher I had. And he accepted that I wasn't verbal, that I wasn't oral. But he didn't like the idea that I could privately, subjectively enjoy poetry and not sound it out loud. He one day discovered that I wrote poetry, and he said to me, this poem is so good, I don't think you really wrote it. I think you plagiarized it, which was a shock to me. And I could admit that it was Longfellow-esque, but it was not certainly stolen from Longfellow. And he said, the way you can prove it to me that you wrote it was to get up in front of the class and recite it by heart. And I accepted the challenge and did it, and we both realized then we had a means, we had a way of regaining the power of speech through reading poetry.
Mm-hmm. So how does the stutter come back very much for you?
You've heard it several times mm-hmm. now. It's always with me, you know. And I have to be careful not to talk too fast.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly becomes a problem whenever I do something emotional, whether in real life or as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
I hit an emotional speech, whether it's a positive emotion or a negative.
Yeah.
Joy or pain. And that often leads to overload, and I have to be very careful. There was a time when my acting was affected by it. I think Gladys Vaughn was the first to notice it. She says, when you get emotional, when your Othello, for instance, gets emotional, I sometimes believe you less. And it's because I'm being too careful. You can't measure out emotion. It has a flow.
Has your Othello ever stuttered?
No, none of my characters have ever stuttered except for the very first thing I did on Broadway. I played the role of Edward, FDR's houseboy, valet, as a young man. I had the line, Mrs. Roosevelt, supper is served. And I got hung on the mama word. It is funny, isn't it? But because it's so ridiculous. Mary Thicket, who was playing Eleanor Roosevelt, was very patient. She just stood there and let me get through it. She knew, the audience knew, that something was wrong, but she didn't want to embarrass me any further by saying my line for me.
Right.
So she let me have my moment. I got through it, and it's never happened since.
Now, what was it like in your early days as an actor, before you had the reputation, before you were James Earl Jones? And you'd go and talk to a casting director, and you'd be stuttering when talking to them, and then you'd have to somehow convince them that on stage you were going to be fine. I mean, casting directors, I'm sure, are pretty insecure about that kind of thing.
No, there was never a problem. I don't know why, but it never was. Marlon Brando and all the method actors had made stuttering a part of the way Americans talk.
Oh, a part of, like, emotional truth that you're grasping so hard for that truth. If you're just joining us, my guest is James Earl Jones. He's written a new autobiography called Voices and Silences. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. James Earl Jones is my guest. In your memoir, Voices and Silences, you devote a total of about a paragraph to Star Wars, to your voice as Darth Vader. And I got the impression that it's not something you really want to call that much attention to.
Are you kidding? Not true. It's just that I have very little to talk about.
Okay.
Had I been one of the actors and given points, I would not only be wealthy, I'd be probably much better known.
You got a flat fee?
Oh, yeah. I think George Lucas, first of all, realized that although David Prowse was the actor he wanted, it was not the sound he wanted. So he searched around for a, technically and symbolically, a darker voice.
Mm-hmm.
He eventually came to me and said to Lucy, would Jenny like to earn a day's salary? The job took 2.5 hours. They paid me all of $9,000, which was not bad for 2.5 hours of work.
Right.
None of us knew what we had, right. You know, and that was fine. Almost not out of embarrassment, but out of his traditionally his non-traditional capitalism or lack of capitalism, George gave me a Christmas bonus that amounted to the same amount of money. But I was just acting as special effects. That's all that was.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I was having done the Great White Hope film. I'd become a member of the board of directors of the Oscar board, you know, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, at a time when the controversy over whether Mercedes McCambridge deserved credit for contributions to the Linda Blair's voice, the devil coming
in the Exorcist.
Yeah, in the Exorcist. And I thought there was a silly argument that I said to myself that all the Mercedes is special effects. And I wanted to keep that clear in my case, so I didn't even take credit for the voice of Darth Vader.
Forgive me, I know this is a small part of your career, but I have to ask you about the CNN voice. The first time someone said to me, you know, I think that's James Earl Jones, I said, nah. You know, I was, no, they're right. And of course, everybody knows this now, that you do the voice of CNN. Why did you decide to take that on when you were offered it?
Oh! You asked me what is the Star Wars involvement meant to me? What it did, it made my voice viable in the commercial world. But I don't know why. I avoided that great way to make a living and great craft unto itself. But the Star Wars sort of put my name on the A list, as they say out there, for authoritative voices.
So your attitude was, why not take advantage of it?
My attitude? Yeah. Oh, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, why kick something that's going to sit on your lap out of the house? I mean, I think the first commercials I did, one for Chrysler and one for Goodyear and one for Fisher products, audio products. And they asked me to just give us the sound of God. Goodyear Vector tires, you know. Let God sell Goodyear Vector tires.
No problem.
They were not embarrassed about saying that, you know.
So do you have a voice of yours that you think of the voice of God?
No. It's just that the sound is let it go as bass as it can go and still be clear.
Yeah,
and to sound like I mean it. And there's not a product I've ever promoted that I don't use, including Wells Lamont gloves, working man's gloves.
And of course, the Yellow Pages.
And Ruben's dinners out in Ruben's chain of restaurants. Orson Welles and Vincent Price and I were once asked to simply, on a recording, read the menu. With as much slobbering, lustful sounds as we can conjure. And we got paid for it.
One quick, very quick last question. Have you ever been in a kind of difficult situation, either on the verge of being mugged or given a traffic ticket that you didn't want to pay or something, where you used your big, authoritative voice to intimidate the other person?
Last time I was mugged, it was multiple muggings, because my first visit to St. Louis, Missouri, at the age of 14, I was mugged several times one afternoon before I figured out what was going on. And in those days, you didn't always get killed when you got mugged.
Right.
You got surrounded by a bunch of kids. They said, give me your money. I said, okay. Being a farm kid, what, you fight over some movie change? The idea of fighting didn't occur to me. So therefore, I was quite safe. The only time I've used the voice, though, in my adult life was when I got my first CB radio, and I used the Darth Vader as my handle. And panicked a few people on the cross country drive from New York to Los Angeles, and I've not done it since.
That's very funny. James Earl Jones, I thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you immensely.
Thank you.
James Earl Jones speaking with Terry Gross. His memoirs are called Voices and Silences. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about some of the stories on All Things Considered today. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Marty. Today we'll be hearing about Russian government leaders changing course on economic reform. A spokesman for the Prime Minister now says that the new economic reform program will only contain some elements of Western-style market economics. Also today, a dispute over a human rights report issued by the Catholic Church in southern Mexico, issued by the church, denied by the Mexican military, that there are human rights abuses in the army's efforts to put down the rebellion by the group called the Zapatistas, and to talk with some Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza who'd like to be the big exporters of a future Palestine.
Robert, thanks. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Beatty is one of Hollywood's most respected character actors. He made his movie debut over 20 years ago in Deliverance. Since then, he has been in nearly 40 movies. He played the insensitive husband in Nashville, the police chief in The Big Easy, and a reclusive Irish tenor in Hear My Song. Now he's the stubborn but soft-hearted Detective Bolander on NBC's Homicide, Life on the Streets. Beatty started in regional theater, spending 15 years on the stage before he made his first film. He grew up in a conservative and religious home in Kentucky. Ned Beatty spoke with Terry Gross in 1987. She asked him about growing up in a home where singing in church was more important than going to the movies.
Going to films was a little bit frowned upon in my family, mostly when it was a nice day. Saturday was movie day for kids in those days, and it was a nice Saturday. My dad was not real thrilled with the idea of us going and sitting in a movie theater. So if he happened to be home, he's a traveling salesman, but if he happened to be home on a sunny Saturday, I didn't get to go to the movies. But I not only went to the movies, I lost my father. My father died when I was 15. And subsequently, pretty soon after that, I started to work at different jobs. And one of the first ones was working as an usher in the movie theater, at which time I started to see a lot of films.
Your first film role was in the movie Deliverance. Did you have any reservations about making your screen debut in a role where the character is raped by a man?
No. It, as far as I can recall, never occurred to me. As a matter of fact, I was sort of, in a way, shocked by how people reacted to that. I was shocked, as a matter of fact, even when we filmed it, how difficult it was for the crew. There were people who didn't want to do the scene. At that point, my feeling about my work, my craft, my art, if you will, was the fact that I simply served the story. So it wasn't in my lexicon of thinking about acting whether or not I was going to be identified with this character and what happened to him.
You mentioned how surprised you were at the cameraman's horrified reaction to the rape scene in Deliverance. And do you think it's a combination of two things? One, the humiliation of rape, but two, a certain amount of homophobia?
I really think it had to do with how well we did the scene.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's a terribly egotistical answer. I think we did it well. The actor who played the rapist, Bill McKinney, is a wonderful actor, and I think it's a scene that would bother anyone. I don't know it has anything to do with homophobia at all. I think it has to do with seeing any time we act out violence and we do it anywhere near how it might actually happen, that's frightening. Because what we've seen is we've seen a lot of violence in films and television over the years, which has no reality to it. When you do a scene that does have some reality to it, it can be very, very riveting.
Did you ever go to drama school?
No, I didn't. I don't know whether it would have done me a great deal of good. I wasn't a very good student ever of anything.
Do you think you have a different acting style from people who you've worked with who are graduates of the Yale School of Drama or who studied the method?
Well, I don't think so. Luckily enough, my university was the theater. And I got to work with actors who worked all kinds of different styles, with directors who worked in all sorts of different ways. I think I picked up on, through reading and through working, picked up on most of the ideas and thoughts about my trade and in those years. What most actors do when they have some experience and have a chance to work around a bit is they pick what works for them. And, and one of the nice things about being an actor is it's never the same. You're never playing exactly the same scene or exactly the same character. And you get to try out different techniques from time to time. I know sometimes I'll pull something out of the sack that maybe I haven't used in 20 years and dust it off and see if this will work. There's a little trick about music. Stanislavski talked about it, and some other acting teachers talked about it, that music can have such a strong and almost kinetic attachment to our emotional system. Sometimes you can just think of a little phrase of a song and it'll get a whole thing going inside you. And every once in a while, when I'm having trouble with, getting the right feeling for a scene, I'll look around for that little piece of melody.
Is there a specific song you've used in certain roles?
There's one that always comes to my mind because I got so tickled when it worked for me. And I will tell you what it is, and you may take from it what you will. But I used to be able to become immediately and violently angry when I would hum a little ditty that we haven't heard so much in recent years called Ain't She Sweet.
Why would that make you angry?
I don't know why it works.
It's a little pop confection.
Yeah, I don't want to analyze it too deeply, but something about bum, 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 da 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 bum, bum. That just turns, I can get every hair on my head standing on end practically by humming that to myself.
I think that's really funny.
Yeah, it is.
I'll always think of you when I hear that song. Ned Beatty, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Jerry.
Ned Beatty now plays Detective Bolander on NBC's Homicide, Life on the Streets. Terry Gross spoke with him in 1987. And finally this, the Arctic blast is beginning to ease its grip on the eastern half of the United States as temperatures inch their way into the double digits. And some of us have actually tried to drive in this weather.
When you try to start your car on a 10-degree winter morning, the car seems to talk to you in a kind of poem of twisted, frozen steel. Put the key in the ignition and you go, please don't try to stop me. Please don't try to stop me. Leave me alone. Leave me alone. There's always an old man who comes along as retired, walking his dog in the morning with advice. You know, watch out, you'll flood it. Don't flood it. Leave me alone.
Comedian Robert Klein from his 1984 recording, Child of the 50s. Fresh Air was produced today by Danny Miller, with Nancy Greenlees, Joan Tuohy, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shark directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and is performed by the Microscopic Septet. Terry Gross will be back on Monday. I'm Marty Moscowane.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, one woman's attempt to unravel the racial legacy of her family. We talk with Shirley Taylor Hayslip. Her family's descendants included an Irish immigrant and a mulatto slave. Hayslip says she looks white but feels black. Her new book is The Sweeter the Juice, a family memoir in black and white. Join us for the next Fresh Air.